Hello, I'm Richard Aidey. This is The Money, the RN show that digs the economics out of everyday life. Well, that's what we usually do. Not this week, though. Actually, not for the last couple of weeks, because we're running a series that does something completely different. Money It's Personal is what it's called, and it looks at the secrecy around personal money. So your money, your family's money, how we feel about it, and how that's often very different to how other people feel. Part three, today's show, is about the rich. If Middle Australia is uneasy being candid about finances, the wealthy are even more so. One of the things you can buy with money is privacy. And so we hear very little from the wealthy on how they feel about having so much. Undaunted, Fenella Suter plunges in and finds that there are actually a few things the rich could complain about. Not that they'd get much sympathy from the rest of us if they did. Here's the third part of Money It's Personal. It isn't easy being rich.
The rich, if I can call them that, have better houses, better parties, better clothes, but they don't necessarily have better conversation or better ideas. I think the rich tend to mix with the rich, maybe to avoid embarrassment. It's a funny subject, money.
I will say the disadvantage of being wealthy is you want more money. The more money you have, the more you want. The more you become looking out for more money, starting to compare why people make more money than I can.
Nobody said I'm filthy rich. I think it would have been seen as immodest. It would have breached the etiquette of egalitarianism.
I know you don't mind talking about money, so I'm going to ask you this. What is your worth at the moment? I read it was $370 million a couple of years ago. Is that still current?
Well, no, I'm not worth as much as that. But people like me never really know. And it's considerable. That's about all that I'd ever say about it. And it's more than enough.
Being wealthy, it's something we're all encouraged to strive for. We're persuaded it's the answer to everything, a shiny, trouble-free state of being, and it certainly has its pluses. But could it also be true that the rich inherit their own set of problems, even if they can contemplate them in greater comfort? It's not the territory of soaring violins, and it's not the stuff of tragedy, but it's not all roses and Learjets either. That's what I wanted to explore in this program, the troublesome underbelly, if you like, below the gilded world of wealth. How do you spend a fortune? How do you raise children who aren't spoilt brats? And if you decide to give money away, how do you actually go about it? Does being rich make you feel more confident or more insecure? I'm Fenella Suter, and this is Money, It's Personal. Media buyer Harold Mitchell says he doesn't know how much he's worth and insists he's a man of modest tastes, despite those hundreds of millions. We met in his offices in South Melbourne. I wondered if he allows himself any luxuries.
Oh, yes, I do. Of course I do. Because it makes my life easier, can make life of other people easier. And so I do. You know, I live in a nice home. Sadly, I got divorced after 50 years of marriage. It was a great tragedy for both my then wife and myself. But we had to split up the assets, and I found we had seven homes. Well, I finished up with two of them. I'm very happy. The rest have gone. So I've got a very nice apartment. I've got a lovely little place up in the mountains. That's the homes that I have. But you would probably know I've got a jet. And you say, oh, hello, what's that got to do? Well, I can tell you, it gets me to different places. I took it to Papua New Guinea with a group of people a week ago. So that we might be able to help the people of PNG. Yes, I've got some of what you might describe as the nice things of having wealth, but I do things with them.
How do you live in seven houses? I mean, how does owning seven houses work? Because most people don't have that experience.
Well, when you find out, you tell me, because it wasn't entirely my idea, I can tell you. I think you just build them up. There was a place up in the mountains where my family happily skied. Wasn't too big, that happened. Of course, there was a place by the beach. I didn't go there. So not really my life, just wasn't the way it was. But my family were happy with it.
Mitchell talks down his wealth, but according to Michael Gilding, a sociologist at Melbourne Swinburne University, Mitchell is the kind of rich person Australians really admire. Gilding is the author of a book called Secrets of the Super Rich. He interviewed 50 people drawn from the BRW Rich List, but they all insisted on anonymity. He reminded me the rich are a mixed bunch.
And there are some people who are absolutely driven, you know, people who've kind of built up their own businesses and they don't know how to stop. And then there are other people who kind of come at it through a corporate pathway. And there are people who inherit. And I think we live in a meritocratic society now where inherited wealth is not regarded highly. People who have made their own wealth are proud of it. They're esteemed for it.
Harold Mitchell is a prime example of a man who made his wealth rather than inherited it, working his way up from tough beginnings to become one of Australia's richest and most influential media buyers.
I grew up in very small country towns, you wouldn't even call them a town, where there was a sawmill, usually about a dozen homes, and built out of timber, obviously, way up in the mountains, and very isolated. And it was a tough time, except I didn't know that then. Young parents, I think my mother must have been 17 or 18 when she married. She'd been a farm girl, and my father probably aged 21 or 2, I think, when I was born. And so it was a tough time because my mother, under great pressure, left our home on quite a number of occasions until finally when I was 15, she left completely. So I left school, left high school as she left. I didn't go to university, obviously. I started as a labourer in a sawmill. I know I arrived in Melbourne aged 16, I think it was, and got a job in an advertising agency. I had no idea what advertising agency was, with the equivalent of $10, not enough to last the whole week, a job, not enough to have food all the time, and one set of clothes. I got a flat. In fact, it was a converted bathroom at the back of a pie shop.
I grew up in a very beautiful house in Toorak. We lived a very comfortable lifestyle. I don't remember ever wanting for anything or needing anything.
In Australia, we value the entrepreneur, but only the first generation can be the self-made man or woman. What about the children who follow? Like Harold Mitchell, Lance Reichstein was a self-made millionaire, and he set up a foundation to share his wealth. But what lessons did he pass on to his only child, Jill, about handling all that money?
He was very generous with it. He travelled a lot for business. He'd always bring me back, you know, nice gifts. And he wasn't a gambler per se, but he loved horse racing. He'd go to the races and he'd come back and he'd buy me a little parcel of shares. So I started my share portfolio with my father's racehorse earnings, and he used to love coming home and saying, "I'm going to buy you some more shares with what I won today." I had pocket money, and there was that notion that I needed to understand how to manage money. So there was certainly a sharing of the family's, you know, the fact that we were comfortable, and that I needed to be conscious and aware that I would at some point inherit money and needed to know how to manage it.
How did he teach you that?
Well, he didn't teach me particularly well because I think he felt that if he surrounded me by people who were his minders, like, you know, the lawyers and the stockbrokers and the accountants, they would do the looking after for me. So when he died, being involved with the foundation and managing the money that he left for me was an uphill battle.
Jill Reichstein did get her head around the finances and runs the foundation to this day, but she knows inherited wealth carries its own set of insecurities.
And I think that's part of the problem of inheriting wealth, that if you haven't actually made it yourself, the fear of losing it is probably greater because you don't know whether you could, you don't have the capacity yourself to invest in that way. And when we started the Women Donors Group maybe 20 years ago, I was really surprised at the number of women who sat around the table who, one, couldn't tell you how much they were worth, and two, how it was managed. And there was a palpable anxiety from these women as to how they would cope if they lost it. Think of the number of people who've made amazing wealth. They lose it, they go back out there and they redefine their lives. But I think if you've been dependent on inherited wealth, you're a lot more cautious.
I don't usually tell people this unless I've known them for a long time, but I mean, I'm really rich?
Yeah, you wish.
No, I mean, my family, my father, actually, was incredibly wealthy, and I inherited all his money, and I don't need to work.
Well, that's great. Good for you.
I always remember one of the people I interviewed saying, look, you know, it's actually really, really, really hard to inherit a whole lot of money, but it's not like I can talk to anybody about this or can expect any sympathy from most people, because most people would love to have lots and lots of money. So some people who inherit fortunes emphasize how much they have built the fortune. Some people just enjoy it. Some people actually don't enjoy it very much at all.
One of those people was an heiress Michael Gilding called Deborah Bryant.
The story of Deborah Bryant was a story of somebody who had inherited millions and millions of dollars, had great wealth at her disposal, but basically planned to give it away in her lifetime. It was a deeply fraught decision for her.
I just felt so uncomfortable. It wasn't my scene at all. To be among people who were obviously quite relishing the fact that they would be the future movers and shakers on the stock exchange and wherever they wanted to go, really. There was such a sense of ease that doors would be opened everywhere. I felt the injustice of it quite keenly. It felt unreal. You know, during my 20s, there were times when I was thinking, I'm mad. How am I going to end up? Because I'm going to be incredibly wealthy. I don't want that to be in the way of my relating to people. From the word go, I started giving money away. I was vehement about it. It's a really bizarre situation. It can be a full-time job.
So in the case of Deborah Bryant, she basically had to live two lives. One life, which was her normal day-to-day activities, which were very, you know, normal. On the other hand, there was the secret life that she was actually the heiress of a very large fortune.
Having lots of money can give you lots of choices, which is a great thing, but having lots of choices can be absolutely paralysing. My siblings don't have these dilemmas. They have big houses and big holiday houses, and they have very different lives from me. They all mix in totally upper-class circles. They mix with other people of similar income. No, not similar income. They mix with other people who've inherited money. So it's all very comfortable because they're all in the same boat. I worry my children will one day ask me why their cousins are wealthier than we are. Why are they getting to fly to Hawaii for their holidays and we can't? That's going to be difficult.
It's a real, real problem. If you're wealthy, what do you do? Do you give your kids lots of money and they waste it, or do you give them not too much and they hate you? I can tell you there is no easy answer.
They don't appreciate, as some of them should, that the efforts I went to save the company and build the company. You know, they say that if you give your children too much, they don't get the joy out of work. They just want the unearned things to keep falling from the sky.
As we know from the bitter falling out between Gina Rinehart and some of her children, for all its advantages, wealth can also create a lot of misery between the generations.
It's absolutely the case that people who grow up in wealthy families struggle with that experience. On the one hand, they have enormous wealth that is coming to them. On the other hand, they didn't earn that wealth themselves. Parents struggle with it because they don't want the children to take their wealth for granted. But on the other hand, the bottom line is that at some stage they're going to know. And I think all wealthy parents struggle with how to bring up their children. The rhetoric around bringing up children is that on no account will we allow our children to be spoiled, and we treat our children in a very down-to-earth manner. That's consistent with the social values around a meritocratic society. In practice, it's actually really hard to do that. In practice, the bottom line is that these children are privileged. The bottom line is that they don't have to learn the skills that actually created the wealth in the first place. And it means that often relationships between parents and children are quite fraught.
How do you teach your children the value of money when there's no shortage of the stuff? Powerful Melbourne executive and philanthropist Michael Ulmer took a hard line.
I do recall once one of my children describing me as the meanest daddy in the world when he correlated how much pocket money I was giving him, and he correlated that to my salary that was published in the annual accounts of Commonwealth Bank the first year I was there. I would guess at that time, after tax, my salary would be the equivalent of about $20,000 a week, and my son was probably getting about $5 a week pocket money. And but that was fine. We didn't change the pocket money, and he had to learn to live with it. And again, it's all around understanding that value of money.
Oh, that reminds me. Did you guys find a place to donate your money? Because I thought of a couple of ideas.
Yeah, we decided we're just going to give it to Tammy's school.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How much?
Don't ask that.
I can, can't I?
No.
$2 million? Shit.
Give the money to Olivia.
Jane, you're working as a maid. You need money.
No, I don't.
And the rich are too rich. And the poor are in desperate trouble in different parts of the world. And it's incumbent upon the rich, I think, one, not to be as rich. I don't believe in taxing people just to say that there should be death duties or even higher taxes. But the responsibility of people over all of the centuries was that you help others. And we need to have another good look at ourselves about that.
Jill Reichstein was raised with that same idea, that you put your wealth to good use. She came of age in the radical 60s, and that shaped her ideas of how she wanted to go about it.
While I was at university, I became quite involved in the anti-Vietnam demonstrations. I became quite political, Monash graduate. While I was at Monash, I became involved in the women's movement, helping setting up the first women's refuge in Victoria through the Women's Liberation Centre. And that gave me a real flavour that actually private money, because with a grant through the Maher Foundation to the Women's Refuge, I could see that private money was an amazing opportunity to create change. And that's where I wanted the Reichstein Foundation to move. And that's where our motto came from, change not charity. We didn't want to be a foundation that merely filled in the gaps that government wasn't going to fund. We wanted to challenge a lot of the policies and the issues that were keeping people entrenched in poverty.
But while we might see philanthropy as a good thing, straightforward and selfless, those with money can sometimes take a dim view of others giving it away.
Well, I have a very dear friend who was trying to raise money for a rather large project at Melbourne University, and that she had spearheaded financially. And when she asked her friends to support it, they would be quite stern and just basically tell her she was showing off, that she had so much money that she could give it away, rather than compliment her on her generosity.
But just how do you decide how much to give away?
In about 2000, I made an extra amount of money which I didn't quite expect to get. It was $10 million, so I gave it away. I put into a foundation, but I decided on two things. One was health, and the other was the arts. And there were things that I was interested in, and I thought we'll make a difference. The arts, not the high arts, just everything, is part of everybody's life. And the amount of money was easy. It unexpectedly arrived there, and so I gave it away. I think we've given away $6 or $7 million. We've got 16 left. So we've done okay. Very clever people looking after, not me. They're very good.
okay, 10 million is very generous, 16 million is generous, but if you're worth hundreds of millions, why stop there? Why not say, oh, okay, I'm going to give 100 million or 200 million?
Yeah. I may not stop there, but I don't, obviously. That's what people know about, but there are other amounts. And I haven't quite worked out yet what you do right at the end, because I don't think I plan to take it with me. And I've made sure that the people around me are well off, my family, so I wouldn't expect to do anything other than continue to help. I think that built into just everybody, no matter how much wealth they've got, what if they run out? And I think that's a fear of life, you know. Just is it a fear of mine? Probably. I'm 73 now, a little bit less so.
I spoke to probably about 10 to 20 people who, out of the 50, who really wanted to talk about their philanthropy and really wanted to talk about the experience of giving it away, and who were getting great satisfaction from giving it away and creating a situation where their children wouldn't simply inherit a massive fortune. But the bottom line is that they were still leaving substantial legacies for their children, and the bottom line is that they weren't planning to give it all away. So giving it all away is an absolute outlier, very unusual.
Basically, there are only four things you can do with money. You can spend it, you can save it, you can invest it, or you could give it away. Only four things you could do with it. So I decided that at a relatively young age, I was going to give away everything I had with warm hands and die broke. And so far, we're right on budget.
The man emptying his pockets is Philip Wallen, a former high-flying corporate executive and one-time vice president of Citibank. He now devotes his wealth to animal rights activism and humanitarian causes, part of his mission to foster global kindness.
Pippa, stop it. I'm going to swap you for a cat.
We met in the home he shares with his wife and two dogs in a comfortable suburb of Melbourne. I asked him if he missed his former life.
Well, it was a wonderful life. It was intoxicating. It was fun. You got to meet very interesting, exciting, intelligent people. You got to work on transactions that really were important, significant ones. But a time came when I knew that I had a different calling. I think I read a book by Burford where he said, in the first half of your life, you're entitled to try to be successful. But in the second half of your life, you should try to be significant. Now, since then, I've changed my mind. I don't think he's right. There's no reason to wait for your second life to do that. You can do something significant today. What happened to me was almost like Paul on the road to Damascus. I discovered that you don't find your character on Wall Street, because ultimately making money is a meaningless exercise. It's the use to which you can put it. I don't describe myself as a philanthropist. I don't know why you do. I call myself a venture capitalist for good causes. I put money into projects that I think will deliver the best bang for my buck, and I take an active interest in the project. And what is money after all? It's an entry in a dusty old ledger or a bit of computer code. That's it. And if that's going to be your metric, I think it's a fairly empty sort of way of measuring your performance.
So if you lost everything tomorrow, then it wouldn't worry you? You're a risk taker.
Oh, I'm sure it would worry me, but I'll survive. And it doesn't matter how dire my straits are. They are nothing compared to the constituents I represent, those poor tortured people and animals behind bars, you know, in cages, in those gulags of despair.
But what's it like to really lose it all? In the first program, we heard from Man Yi talking about her impoverished childhood in Hong Kong. She went on to make millions on the stock exchange.
So I quit my job, come to Australia, meet up with my husband. Even though we married for many years, but I said, I love money too much, darling. I have to stay in Hong Kong. Then at that stage, I feel wealthy enough that I don't need to work. I come to Australia. But then 1 year later, financial market crashes. Every paper money I have, I lost. And in fact, I owe the bank more money than I can afford to pay back. A few million Australian dollars.
How did you feel when you lost that money at that time? I mean, now you seem very quite philosophical about it, but how was it at the time?
Devastating. Never in my life I dreamt of having so much money in my life. And never in my life I dreamt I can able to foresee I own banks so much money.
Manyi pulled herself out of debt, and she now looks back on that stage of her life without regret.
Between the two stages of rich and poor, can I say there's no differences? And I will always say money gave me choices. With no money, I still have choices. But then the choices is in my mind. I will still go to the shop. When I have no money, I go for special. I thought I can't cope. I couldn't go to the big expensive shops. May I use the names like Louis Vuitton, Prada, or walk-in? But then what I have to do is change my attitude. I don't go to those shops anymore. I now go to $2 shop. Then I still have choices, but just $2.
Do you think it's brought you greater happiness, being wealthy?
Oh, not necessarily. I wouldn't say that. No. Money doesn't make you happy. I've had the battles in life that people might have. I fought my weight for a long time. In the early part of my 20s, an alcoholic, and not for long, and I stopped, and haven't drunk for 50 years. So not that a lot of money then, but none of those things made it any easier. Sadly, I got divorced, and money didn't help any of that. But it's been a good life because of it. The disadvantages are fairly clear. Firstly, a lot of other people know that you're wealthy, and so that means you sometimes wonder why it is that they're dealing with you. Is it because you are who you are, or how you can help them, or is it because of the money? I'm very lucky that I've been around for a long time, and it seems to work okay with me. But that can be a great disadvantage of it, and probably the biggest one of all.
Next time, why the reluctance to talk about our financial affairs, even with our closest friends? And is it the same in all cultures?
The shyness about talking money in the Chinese community, we have no shyness at all. In fact, more or less, the first question they will ask you is how much you earn? How old are you? How much do you weigh? The way they judge a person is how much you earn.
Listen, all you fools out there, go on and love me, I don't care.
Fenella Suter with part 3 of Money, It's Personal, co-produced with Kathy Gollan. Mark Don's the sound engineer. Next week promises to be a cracker. I'm Richard Ady. Hope you join me then.